From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the last of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, In Our Own Time, The Tragedy of the St. Louis. Introducing Professor Wiesel is the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack.
Virtually no one was ever intentionally murdered in the Dutch concentration camp called Westerbork. At least 102,000 Dutch Jews passed through it, though, where they were both processed and shipped to such other infamous killing centers as Auschwitz, Sobibor, and Bergen-Belsen. When you got to Westerbork, if you even half understood what this place was about, you worked with every last ounce of energy left to you to achieve one goal, to keep your name and the names of your family members off the transportation lists out of Westerbork. A new train reliably left Westerbork every Tuesday morning at 11 o'clock. If you were on it, or if you were on the transportation list for the train, you were, for the most part, never heard from again. One of the ways to keep off the list, it turns out, was to be sick. Westerbork had a hospital with 1,000 beds, three operating theaters, a large staff of doctors and nurses that sponsored professional medical conferences, and an overall physician in charge, the Jewish director of the hospital, one Dr. Spanier. Spanier thus had powers of life and death over the prisoners of Westerbork, which he exercised usually with compassion. I bring up Spanier because Elie Wiesel asked me to. Spanier and his twin daughters were survivors of the St. Louis. Apparently, one of the twins is still alive and living in New Jersey. She refuses to discuss the war years. What was it to have been refused entry to so many ports? What was the impact on your soul of not being wanted by people anywhere? How could it not affect who you became? How could it not make you cynical beyond any definition of the term? What did it make you think, not of the Germans, but of those who turned down your asylum anywhere? The St. Louis survivors had a clearer vision of what they could expect from the rest of the world than most others. What kind of people, what kind of survivors did they become? No one. No one is more sensitive to these kinds of questions than is Elie Wiesel. Even as I say these lines, I realize that it is his initial response to the Holocaust that gave birth to these kinds of questions, that his reading of the Shoah continues to direct and shape our understanding of that which defies understanding. Ladies and gentlemen, if my math is right, I introduce you to his 99th lecture at Boston University, Professor Elie Wiesel.
St. Louis, a place, a vessel, a name, a concept, a memory, a dark cloud in the sky, fraught with peril. Call it a moral Titanic. St. Louis is the name of a ship, and that ship belongs to Jewish memory. She reminds us of Jewish loneliness in Germany, and also of the free world's complacency, indifference, and scandalous ethical failure in refusing to save hundreds of innocent victims in danger. We say St. Louis, and the next word that comes to mind is sadness and infinite shame. Sadness for the victims and shame on the persecutors and on their helpers and sympathizers. St. Louis also brings justified embarrassment to the names of those who were then leaders of freedom-loving nations. They failed the test of humanity towards those who felt forgotten and abandoned, counted for nothing by so many happy people in so many lands. But there was a hero in this sad and melancholy story. Who was he? We know who its victims were, more than 900 men, women, and children, all Jews, who fled imprisonment and torment. We also know who the indifferent spectators were, democratically elected leaders of big and small nations. Their lack of solidarity cannot be invoked as a reason to forsake hope, not even in an era of pre-darkness. The hero of the story is a German, a star of the Merchant Marine, the young 37-year-old captain of a large, magnificent transatlantic passenger vessel, and his name is Gustav Schröder. He made moral history. He will be remembered as the humanist of the St. Louis. Today in class we discussed a book about righteous Gentiles, and the first part of that book is filled with horror, pain, despair. And then at one point the author changes just direction to tell us that there were sparks, human sparks, or sparks of humanity even in those years. One here, one there, in Hungary, in the Ukraine, and Romania, and even in Germany, there were. And thanks to them, hope is permitted, even today. How about, therefore, tonight, the St. Louis, where does the tale begin? In 1933, when Hitler became the dictatorial chancellor of the Third Reich and hurriedly ordered the establishment of the first infamous concentration camps, where prisoners were brought only to undergo public humiliation and cruel deprivation? Or should we begin when the outbreak of the first anti-Jewish activities became official German policy, official German philosophy, or when the horrendous anti-Semitic Nuremberg laws were announced and immediately, shamelessly implemented? People knew then, as they remember now, the Jews in Hitler's Germany lived in constant fear. They could not be protected by law, since the law was the enemy. It was lawful to deprive them of their livelihood, of their safety, of their joy, of their hope, of their possibilities to go on living, in short, of all that today we would call their basic human rights. All the new anti-Semites used their instantly gained prestige and power to surpass one another in who would beat up more Jews in the most ferocious and ugly manner in the streets, in the cellars, in prisons. No wonder so many targeted victims were eager to pick up their belongings, leave their homes and businesses, and emigrate. But where? Anywhere. Thousands upon thousands of Jewish men and women of all ethnic and national origins, professions, and social spheres besieged foreign consulates. Long, endless lines surrounded the American, French, British, South African, Australian, and Canadian consulates. A joke was going around in Berlin. Two men, more fortunate than others, meet in the street. And one says, "I'm getting a visa." "Where?" "For Shanghai." "And you, do you have a visa?" He says, "Yes." "Where?" He said, "Mine is for Tierra del Fuego in Argentina." And the first one said, "But that's far." And his friend answers, "Far from where?" Strange as it may sound now, just as Jews wanted to leave, the German authorities wanted them to get out. In those years, that was their goal. Hitler's objective was not yet extermination, but racial purification. He and his followers called it Judenrein. Just that, to patriotically and happily dwell in their land without a trace of Jews. That was their socio-political objective, their fanatical dream. In fact, Adolf Eichmann's first position at the Gestapo was to help German and Austrian Jews leave Germany legally, and even choosing illegal border crossings. Eichmann tried to help them do that. High-level negotiations were also underway between the Jewish agency and German high officials involving the so-called transfer or Havara project, allowing Jewish immigrants to bring some of their expensive machinery to Palestine. And so Haifa and Naharia quickly became inhabited by German-speaking immigrants. That was the language more than Hebrew, German. In general, anyone who had a visa could leave. And that applied even to concentration camp inmates. In fact, some Zionist activists were liberated from Buchenwald since their names were on appropriate lists of emigration to Palestine. Heydrich himself, actually, allowed the St. Louis passengers to leave the country. So eager Berlin was to get rid of the Jews. Persons with great wealth or reputation had it easier. Thomas Mann and Franz Werfel, Sigmund Freud and Peter Lorre, Bertolt Brecht, Hannah Arendt, Fritz Lang, and a number of scholars and scientists, not all Jews, succeeded early on in finding ways to leave total fear and fortune behind and uproot themselves for good. Two events sealed the fate of many others: the Avignon Conference in October and Kristallnacht in November. Kristallnacht is actually 20 years ago. November 9th. When the Berlin Wall came down, I published an op-ed article in the New York Times, in which I expressed, of course, my delight that democracy won, that communism collapsed, that the Soviet Empire is gone, and therefore that the Berlin Wall came down. I was very happy for that. But I said in my article, "I am worried, but then I am a Jew, I'm a worrier. I always worry. And I was worried that who knows what will happen soon. This day, November 9, will now be remembered for the downfall of the wall in Berlin. And the other event, Kristallnacht, will be forgotten. And it has been forgotten. Except for here at Boston University, where else is Kristallnacht being remembered? Years ago, it was. Now, but we remember, and we spoke about it last year, the state organized pogrom in all German major and minor cities was conceived and implemented as an act of collective vengeance for the individual assassination of a German diplomat in Paris by a Polish-Jewish youngster named Herschel Grinspan. Remember from last year, hundreds of synagogues, in fact, some figures have it, 1,400 synagogues, big and small, were set aflame. Countless businesses ransacked. Hundreds of Jews were imprisoned and taken to Dachau and Buchenwald. This time, the international community was outraged. The condemnation was quasi-planetary. President Roosevelt went as far as recalling his ambassador from Berlin. The Avignon Conference preceded that pogrom. The world had already become painfully aware of the refugee problem. At that time, it affected mainly, if not only, Jews in Germany and recently annexed Austria. Where could they go? Which country would offer them rescue and shelter? Roosevelt had an idea. Immediately and even symbolically open the gates of our country? America? No. His idea was just call a conference. Call an international conference to deal with the situation. And now everybody could breathe easier. Chaired by a French diplomat, the gathering took place in a French spa resort, Evian. Hugely covered by the world press, and especially by the German media, it opened on July 6, 1938. 32 nations participated in its discussions. Hitler declared, I quote him, "I hope that the world's sympathy towards the criminals, meaning Jews, will be translated in acts. Germany is ready to hand them over on luxury ships." I repeat, Germany was ready to hand over its Jews, living Jews, on luxury ships. Some 40 Jewish organizations and NGOs were treated with disdain at that conference. The World Jewish Congress was allotted 5 minutes. The representative of German Jewry, the same. The entire endeavor quickly turned into a farce. All official representatives, with the temporary exception of the Dominican Republic, expressed sympathy for the refugees, but each and every one explained why his or her country was unable to accept them. The French delegate said that his country was already demographically, quote, saturated with foreigners. That's precisely what Foreign Minister Bonnet, Georges Bonnet, privately told Ribbentrop. France does not want more refugees on its soil in 1938. Great Britain was in the middle of preparing a white book limiting Jewish immigration to Palestine. America held on to its sacred quotas. Various alternatives began floating around. Why not send the stateless and homeless refugees to Madagascar, of all places? France opposed it. Its influential minister, Georges Mandel, though Jewish, declared, "There will never be a Jewish community in Madagascar." How about Ethiopia? Mussolini said no. How about Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Guyana? The German reaction, an article in the Danziger for Post newspaper. Quote, the Evian conference vindicates the German policy towards the Jews. No country will accept a few thousand Jews. Why should we? Switzerland dispatched one of its most influential ministers to Berlin, where he met with the head of the Gestapo, or the Minister of Justice, and suggested to him that all Jews should, on their passports and IDs, have the letter J printed. Other governments of occupied countries soon followed. And the idea was, therefore, they will not be allowed in Switzerland and later on anywhere else. What does that mean, really? Too sad the story. Its sadness will grow every day, with every incident deeper and deeper. Its memory of tragically closed doors will continue to haunt our own for generations to come. This is the story of St. Louis. Now, as a good student, I went back to history and tried to understand who really was St. Louis, after whom the ship after was named. Actually, the name St. Louis predates the tragic event as we are dealing with here tonight. In Jewish collective memory, it also evokes a period of animosity, enmity, and implacable ill will. King Louis of France, the 9th of 18 French sovereign rulers, attained sainthood, of course, posthumously. As is the custom, the title and the honor awarded to him covered his lifetime work for the glory of his church in the 13th century. So the Jew in me cannot but wonder, what made him so special that the highest Vatican leadership, headed by the Pope, decided to turn him into an example to be admired and followed by the entire Catholic Church for all time to come? There must have been other reasons for that decision, but the one that interested me was his extreme hatred for Jews and the Jewish faith. Those were not easy times for Jews, but his hatred went beyond that of many others. In those times, the Middle Ages, other kings in France and elsewhere disliked Jews in their own ways. Some even protected them, as did some popes. But in matters of discrimination, with the exception of King Ferdinand of Spain, none surpassed that of Louis IX. During the Bloody Crusades, he refused to protect Jewish victims in his provinces. In 1240, the famous disputation between the great Rabbi Yechiel ben Yosef and the apostate Pablo Cristiani took place in Paris. We all know that disputation. We all know all these disputations. In some ways, they were very important for us because they forced both sides to learn more about the other. On orders of the royal palace, realizing that the representative of the church was not faring too well, the king commented, quote, this is Louis IX. Rather than discuss matters of faith with a Jew, the Christian layman should plunge his sword into him. In Rome, Pope Innocent IV felt obliged to declare, and that is to his credit, that no one can study scripture without a Talmud. King Louis of France threatened to expulse from the country any Jew caught with the possession of a Talmudic tractate. He went even against his own pope. Following his orders, in 1242, 24 carloads of Jewish books, especially the Talmud, were publicly set on fire. Furthermore, it was he who, influenced by Pablo Cristiani, ordered all his Jewish subjects to listen to Christian missionary sermons and to wear a distinctive badge of shame in the cities, villages, and streets of his kingdom, thus preceding the yellow star of the German law. So why was he included among the saints of the Catholic Church? I really want to know, because those of you who know me, I have respect for religion, all religions. So I want to understand what made him so special, so saintly. I don't know. 7 centuries later, St. Louis now is a ship, May 13, 1939. German Jews are embarking on the beautiful 8-decked ocean liner St. Louis. Of the Hamburg American Line in festive Hamburg, which is celebrating its 750th anniversary, 400 passengers paid $320 for first-class cabins. 500 were in tourist class. All tickets were in a way round trip. It was Saturday. So 30 pious Jews had come aboard a day earlier. All were personally greeted by the ship's captain, Gustav Schröder. At the pier, customary music was played in honor of the departing passengers. The 231-member crew followed the captain's specific solemn orders to treat them with special attention and courtesy. He went dangerously far in trying to please them by removing Hitler's official photo from the ballroom, which was transformed into a temporary synagogue. The moment the vessel left the shore, the passengers' mood became good, uplifted, cheerful. The uncertainty of their future didn't bother them. What was certain was that they would not have to endure any more vicious German anti-Semitism. They knew that far away in Cuba, their immediate destination, life would be bearable, at least. They all had in their possession official American quota numbers and special Cuban certificates allowing them to stay in transit while waiting for American visas. How long? Probably a few months or even years, but in the meantime, they might find ways to adjust to their new surroundings. The first real signal of a possible problem reached the captain on the 23rd of May. He was informed that Cuba's president, Federico Laredo Bru, issued a law effectively prohibiting the passengers from disembarking in Cuba. Why? Neither the passengers nor the captain knew this. Pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic articles in major newspapers produced unprecedented hostility to Jews in Cuba. The largest anti-Jewish demonstration in its history had taken place there just around that time, and it had an impact on the president. Schröder had, almost from the beginning, established a special passenger committee to discuss any eventuality, including this one. So he informed them that he decided not to return to Hamburg. So let life go on undisturbed. Good meals offered and taken regularly. Entertainment, religious services. The St. Louis continued to Havana, where they arrived on the 26th of May. It was again Saturday. Armed Cuban police immediately boarded the vessel. The passengers were told that only those among them with official visas would be allowed to disembark. 22 left the ship. The others remained her prisoners, whose mood instantly changed. Weeping relatives of some tried to meet them without success. Scenes of panic and despair have been recorded by protagonists and journalists. From a variety of circles, political pressure and economic rewards were employed. Pathetic news stories began appearing in the Western press. An important official of the influential American Joint Distribution Committee, as we call them, the Joint, Lawrence Berenson, met with President Brew. A long conversation with emotional moments ensued. Huge sums were discussed and offered. Others also interceded. A variety of interventions took place with officials and private personalities who were close to power. But Havana remained unmoved, resulting in increased fear among the passengers. One of them, a distinguished lawyer from Berlin, Max Loewy, fearing unavoidable return to Germany, attempted suicide by cutting his wrists and jumping into the sea. He was saved and brought to a local hospital. The captain felt compelled to appoint a special joint team now to patrol the vessel and watch for possible imitators. The mood was such that people were considering suicide. Thanks to the patrol, there were no more suicides. But now the passengers' only hope could be and was America. So passengers began sending heart-rending cables all over the world. One went to Cuban President Brew's wife, the First Lady, appealing to her as a woman and a mother. Time was running out. 7 Latin American countries, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Panama, Paraguay, and Uruguay, were approached with monetary offers. All said no. President Brew personally asked the captain to move his ship out of Cuban waters. Schroeder remained loyal to the passengers. He felt responsible for their welfare and their future. Though ordered by his company again and again to return the vessel and its passengers to Germany, to their home base, he chose to bring the ship to American shores, while at the same time continuing the negotiations with local Cuban authorities, maybe to do something, to bring about a change of policy. In the meantime, the St. Louis was still in the harbor. Schroeder, in civilian clothes, went ashore, asking to meet with a special envoy of the president. The captain mentioned the suicide of Max Loewy, warned against more. Extreme behavior of passengers was not to be excluded. He described their mental anguish, their disarray, their disorientation, the despair of mothers, the suffering of children. The Cuban high official answered that if the St. Louis did not move into international waters forthwith, the Cuban Navy would have to intervene and force the ship to move. In his diary, Schroeder remembered the good captain, the good German Captain Schroeder wrote. Frightening, he said. Even slaves in antiquity had monetary value. Jews have none. So again and again he reassured his passengers that whatever happened, he would not bring them back to Germany. In that moment, he became their sole anchor and their sole savior. Soon Schroeder concluded that he had no choice. the ship had to leave Cuba. She did. Still heading not to Europe but to Florida. Again, she had to stay outside territorial waters, this time America's. And here the international press was waiting. All the newspapers, the major newspapers from the world. The story occupied headlines all over the country and abroad. Max Lewis' pathetic suicide attempt was reported in national dailies and weeklies. Consequently, pleas were addressed everywhere. The tragedy of so many homeless Jews, unwanted by all countries, and risking the worst in Hitler's Germany, touched the heart of simple people. The Washington Post wondered, I quote, "There are sanctuaries for birds and nature everywhere in the United States, except for over 900 persecuted human beings." Heartbreaking telegrams from desperate passengers were sent to the State Department, no answer. To President Roosevelt in the White House, no answer. Another one to his wife, Eleanor. She later confessed in her memoirs her sorrow for not having done enough for the St. Louis refugees. And she said that it was, quote, "the deepest regret at the end of her life," unquote. We understand why. Doris Kearns Goodwin, the renowned historian of the American presidency, in her book No Ordinary Time, quotes a letter an 11-year-old wrote to Mrs. Roosevelt. That an 11-year-old girl wrote to Mrs. Roosevelt, I quote her, "I am so sad," not on the boat, from America, "I am so sad the Jewish people have to suffer so. Please let them land in America. It hurts me so that I would give them my little bed because it was the last thing I had. Let us Americans not send them back to that slaughter, to that slaughterhouse. We have 3 rooms we do not use. Mother would be glad to let someone have them." No answer. In other words, as far as world leaders were concerned, whatever was happening only to Jews. So why bother? Question, what was the Jewish response in the world? Jewish communities at large must have been distressed. Some passengers had relatives in America. They must have been sensitive to their pain. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau suggested granting the refugees temporary visas. And the idea was rejected higher up in the administration. Some religious voices were heard, both Jewish and Gentile, but they were not powerful enough to influence policy in the White House. While this was going on, the captain received again an unambiguous order from his superiors, return to Hamburg immediately. Under duress, Schroeder left the American shore on June 6th. From discussions with joint representatives, he knew that their activity had now already moved to Europe, and he kept his word. His Jews would not be handed over to their persecutors. To a friend, he confided his secret decision and resolve that if all else failed, and no help given from European nations, he would sabotage the vessel. As for the passengers, certain European governments were finally willing to accept a number of them. Thanks to the efforts of Maurice Tropper, the Joint European Director, Antwerpen was the first stop. King Leopold III of Belgium accepted 200 passengers. The Queen of Holland, 194. Great Britain, 350. France, 250. But, except for those who went to England, many, if not most of the others, including those in Westerbork of whom Rabbi Pollack spoke, ended up in Auschwitz. Still, we must remember that. We must also remember that only European nations felt guilty enough to open their doors to the passengers of St. Louis. The United States did not. And this is both sad and shocking. Now it's clear that America's behavior towards European Jews during Hitler's reign remains far from being honorable, surely not praiseworthy. Example. We mentioned earlier that as a noble response to the Kristallnacht, President Roosevelt recalled his ambassador from Berlin. But soon afterwards, a State Department high official wrote in a memorandum, quote, "This cannot interfere in any way with our relations, political or commercial, with Germany. And our interests in Germany must not and will not suffer." As for the Evian Conference, America's attitude was not much better, nor any worse, than that of all other nations. During a subsequent press conference, when the International Committee on Refugees created by the Evian Conference was totally inactive, President Roosevelt was asked by a journalist about it. What would happen to the refugees? The Evian Conference would look after them, he answered. Had the president any idea where they would go? He had considered the matter at length, he said, but was not yet prepared to make a statement. Would he recommend to ask Congress to change the law so as to allow more refugees? And the answer was, no. The fact is that due to the destructive work of an anti-Semitic Undersecretary of State, Breckinridge Long, and his close associates, America's attitude towards Jewish refugees and victims in Europe were deplorable, to say the least. And they all believed that they were following Roosevelt's guidelines. But other nations do not deserve compliments either. Again, to Switzerland, Jewish refugees were almost by definition and by law categorized as undesirable aliens. France, after Kristallnacht, Hitler's foreign minister von Ribbentrop was invited to Paris to sign a kind of friendship alliance or something. He was given a festive state dinner, and in order not to embarrass him, Jewish members of the cabinet and the parliament were not invited. The president of the parliament, an honorable man, Edouard Herriot, in meaningful solidarity with them, declined the invitation, but others did not. Some great intellectual figures did speak up, to their credit and to their honor. Eugene O'Neill, John Steinbeck, Pearl Buck, Eddie Cantor, Thornton Wilder, and Clifford Odets, and others denounced America's diplomatic complacency in a statement, quote, 35 years ago, a horrified America rose in protest against the pogrom in Kishinev in Tsarist Russia. God have pity on us if we have become so insensitive to human suffering that we are incapable of protesting today against the pogroms in Nazi Germany. We believe it is profoundly immoral for Americans to continue to maintain commercial relations with a country which openly adopts mass murder to solve its economic problems. How are we to understand America's policy in the late 30s? Evian was before, but St. Louis came after Kristallnacht. Now the whole world knew what Hitler had done to German Jews, to Austrian Jews. Now the whole world knew the fury of hatred, the horrors, the manhunts, the public humiliations, the arrests, the torture, the flames, the terror. And more than 900 Jews men, women, and children were sent back to Germany from Cuba, from American shores? Perhaps we ought to view this episode within the context of the general political and economic situation in our country. Was Roosevelt anti-Jewish? Though I still find it regrettable and humanly inadmissible, his refusal to bomb in 1944 the railways leading to Birkenau, I cannot believe that he felt animosity towards Jews. I cannot believe that he had anything of anti-Semitic in him. He was a hero, a kind of father figure to the Jewish people. I said it many times, I must have said it here. In my little town, I, the student of a yeshiva, I never knew then the name of David Ben-Gurion, but I knew the name of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as our protector, as our friend. So how is one to explain his behavior? He knew that he was beloved and admired. As the saying goes, some of his old closest allies and advisors were Jews. But then he had to take care of burning domestic issues. I know that. Studying history, I know that. Both labor unions and the right-wing militants were against immigration. They said, we have our own problems here. Why do we need new ones? They didn't want new immigrants. Most statistical surveys indicate similar attitudes of a vast majority of Americans. And then, as some of you have read, you are too young, have read that, there was a man named Father Coughlin, and his hate-mongering radio broadcasts inspired hatred to millions of listeners. And then there was the German Bund, an official party in America. Remember, if you see the pictures on television, you can't believe it. They had staged pro-Hitler parades in Madison Square Garden with swastikas, Nazi uniforms, shouting Heil Hitler in the thousands. They had their own summer camps for the young Nazis. The whole world knew that in America, Hitler had so many admirers. Is it possible that Roosevelt, even there, was somehow sensitive to the possibility of misinterpretation, of being interpreted as too Jewish or too pro-Jewish? But how can one ignore this element in the equation? One cannot, but is it enough for me to accept the situation as it was? What the Jew in me fails to understand is, well, in consulting the sources of that period, while the St. Louis drama was unfolding, I do not find a strong, adequate Jewish response either by the leadership or by the population on the level of communal and organizational cooperation. I wonder, were there mass demonstrations? Were there petitions with hundreds and thousands of signatures? If yes, I haven't found them. Have we mobilized congressional support? I don't know. I repeat, the national and international press had done its work, had fulfilled its obligation. Its mission was accomplished honorably. The press reported everything. Reports on the tears shed and the nightmares endured on the St. Louis while in Florida. It was in the press. What happened on the way to Germany, in the press? Were they heard, absorbed, and acted upon in the appropriate circles? Were there delegations sent to the White House, to the State Department, to congressmen? Did they knock on doors? Were there emergency reunions held to plan immediate assistance and rescue? What was done to urge the administration to temporarily and exceptionally change the quota system? Was there a sense of urgency in our community, my Jewish community, justifying the traditional commitment to Ahavat Israel or solidarity with Jews in peril? Did we proclaim a day of fast? Could it be that Roosevelt had something to do with the European nation's decision not to allow the St. Louis to bring her passengers back to Hitler's dead servants? Is it possible that if France and Britain and they all accepted, was thanks to Roosevelt's intervention? If so, then I withdraw, I retract what I said. Then maybe he did the right thing in his own way. Perhaps French, British, Belgian, and Dutch archives do contain documents to that effect, but I have found no trace of them in American sources nor in others. In a French novel of all places, I read of one rumor about a conversation of all topics on moral philosophy Roosevelt had in Warm Springs a few days before his death with his close friend and confidant Harry Hopkins. And the main question there dealt with Hitler's crimes against the Jewish people. He wanted to know more from the moral viewpoint, more what was done to help Jews, and if not, why not? One strange revelation we find in archival documents shows that the shipping company was fully aware of the difficulties waiting for the vessel in Havana. Certain humanitarian agencies, including the Joint, had been forewarned. Scores of cables, phone messages, and memoranda are here to prove it. If they knew, so did Berlin. Only the passengers were kept in the dark. But the question still remains. If so many people involved in the project knew, why did Berlin permit the ship to sail towards the unknown? Why did German officials not stop her? The ship was still in Hamburg. On May 8, 1939, the Society of Nations High Commissioner for Refugees sent an official letter to President of Hayas, an all-Jewish organization for immigrants, strongly asking him to cancel the journey. He also cabled the same message to the shipping company in Hamburg. In other words, Havana had, on the highest level, informed Berlin that the St. Louis passengers' papers would be considered illegal. The passengers would therefore not be allowed to land on Cuban territory. But why then did the vessel undertake the passage? Granted, as was mentioned earlier, each passenger had to purchase a round-trip ticket. But with such knowledge about certain difficulties, wouldn't it have been more advisable to cancel or at least delay the departure altogether? Which elicits another more poignant question to be put before the student of history. Mind you, whatever the answer may be, it would not alleviate the world's responsibility in the case. But the question itself does shed a new somber light on the whole situation. Is it possible that Germany did not want the passengers to disembark in Cuba from the outset? It was an exercise again to show the world that nobody wants the Jews, so why should they keep the Jews? Just to illustrate, therefore, what Berlin had been repeating before and during the Evian conference and talking to so many world statesmen, they all said, take the Jews. We don't want them. Take them. And since you don't want them, don't give us any advice what to do with them. Interestingly, while the St. Louis episode occupied front pages all over the world, it had drawn less attention in Palestine, of all places. Its daily newspapers devoted amazingly few lines to the plight of its Jewish passengers. The headlines dealt mainly with something else, a political event that had what, at that moment, journalists could have considered having only an indirect connection with their pain and anguish, the publication of the outrageous British White Book against Jewish immigration to Palestine. That was the principal occupation of the readers and the editors and the people in Palestine. Well, when it comes to the St. Louis, as in general with anything that has to do with that tragedy, which was the greatest in recorded history, all questions remain unanswered and disquieting. There are others. For whenever we approach any theme, directly or even indirectly related to that tragedy, which we so poorly call the Holocaust, we stumble upon endless interrogations. We simply don't know. We study it now in class for this semester. It's painful. Painful teaching, painful study with my students. I see the pain on their faces, and it hurts me to cause them that pain. Because we always stumble with them. How could it happen, and why did it happen? And in truth, this terrible tragedy could have been prevented so many times if only the world had been less indifferent. Well, we come to the end of this year's research and accountant that study together. There are, even in our fragmentary analysis of how evil plagued the last century, there were those who covered humanity with shame, but again, there were also those who brought it honor. And there were many of them. The number that Yad Vashem speaks about is 50,000, one even goes more, 100,000 who deserve the medal for righteous Gentiles. Numbers really don't count there, but the fact is that there were, the choice existed. That is the lesson that we have. The choice existed. On any level, there was always a moment of choice when the person in charge, or the person who was official or not, or a simple peasant who saw this crowd being chased to the ravines of Babi Yar, or a person with absolutely no education almost, could open the door simply to pull in a child or a woman or an old man and say, come stay, I'll save you. The choice remains. The choice is always there. There are people that deserve that honor, and Gustav Schroeder was one of them. He deserved the Hasidu Mot HaOlam medal, and he got it. I wish I had met him, but he died in 1957. Another man I wish I had met was the Czech block eldester of the Children's Block 66 in Buchenwald. We were there 400 children, adolescent children. The youngest one was Rav Yisrael Lau, who was chief rabbi of Israel. Why? Because on April 5th, the loudspeakers in every block said all Jews must go to the Appellplatz, and we knew what it meant. The local resistance, by the way, composed of Scandinavian police students, said, don't go, it's not good for you. And the block elster, that block elster, a Czech Gentile, spent the entire night in his office together with his collaborators, actually registering all of us as Christians. So I was a Christian for one night. But he saved our lives. When I came to Prague, together with President Havel, my close friend, to open a conference that the both of us organized, the first thing I wanted was to meet that man. Came too late. He had died 2 months earlier. The other person I really wanted was a maid in our family. She was a maid, a marvelous woman. I think she, of course, she was there when I was born already. A simple peasant woman, very religious, illiterate. And she sneaked into the ghetto, bringing us food. And when the deportations began, she came back to the ghetto. And I remember the meeting we had in our little room. And she was pleading with my father. She had no idea where we were going, nor did we. She simply said, "Don't go. I have a hut in the mountain. I'll take care of you." Had we known that Auschwitz was our destination, of course, we would have followed her. I went back, my hometown, 20 years later. The first person I wanted to see was she had died. So there were good people too. The lessons from all what was said is simple. One, waiting in certain crises, both individual, collective, is a sin. Two, to be silent in moments of danger is a sin. Silence never helps the victim, only the victimizer. Three, even those European countries who at the end did accept some of the passengers could have done so earlier, or why not, immediately. In doing so, they would have spared the refugees nights and weeks of pain and anguish, and a possibility to find some good, righteous Gentiles in France itself. When help is required, better offer it right away. If there is a blessing or a bracha in our tradition for charity, it is none to be said. There is no such blessing, because the blessing might take too long. So give charity, help right away. Then, when victims need assistance or intervention, do not rely on others to do it for you. They may rely on you, not on them. The needed help will never come if you don't offer it. And then, never give in to despair. Never give up on man's capacity for hope. Remember, only another human being can push me to resignation. But also only another human being can move me to moral elevation. And then remember always the mantra which I gave here the three weeks ago. When students ask me, what should we take away from our classes or from your books, I always give them the same answer. Whatever you will do in life, whatever your dreams will lead you, remember, think higher and feel deeper. In conclusion, an ancient Midrashic and Hasidic tale. I found it in both sources. There was a man in a boat, and all of a sudden people around him saw him digging a hole under his seat. They began screaming at him, "What are you doing? Are you crazy?" And he answered, "It's none of your business what I'm doing. It's my seat. I paid for it." What he didn't know then was something that we know now. We are ultimately always, all of us, in the same boat.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the last of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In Our Own Time, The Tragedy of the St. Louis. Introducing Professor Wiesel was the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jarrett Mooney and Ryan Peterson. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.